ahead and get started. Fairly full agenda this afternoon. First, we have the annual department review for human resources. Linda, I assume you'll step us through.
I will. Thank you. Good afternoon, everybody. It's a beautiful afternoon, and so we're thrilled that so many of you came to hear an overview of the human resource department. We're thrilled to showcase what we do in HR. It's not every day we get to be in front of you. So thank you for the opportunity, and welcome other staff and guests for this overview. I want to start today by first and foremost acknowledging what a privilege it is to lead the human resource team that I do. You have an A-plus team working for you. They are dedicated professionals who work long hours, who really care about what they do for the city of Rochester. So let me introduce them. To my right is Barb Laturski. Barb is an HR specialist, so Barb, if you want to stand up. Over here we have Christine Soltow. For a few more weeks, Christine is currently the benefits and safety administrator. She's about ready to give up the safety administrator role thanks to your action. Next to her is Kari Kaus. Kari is our payroll and HRIS benefits specialist. And then next to her is Jennifer Simpson. And Jennifer is a senior HR consultant. And I think Tim Comstock will be joining us shortly, too. He's on his way over from RPU, so they'll be shortly here. But anyway, it's an honor to work with such a great group of colleagues. Every day coming to work is really a thrill just because we have so much support and dedication from this group of people. So let me walk you through where we're going to go today on our roadmap. We're going to talk about HR core services. Core services are those things that we do every day just to operate the business at a very basic level. For example, we need to pay our employees, we need to recruit employees, we need to make sure they have a good benefits package, and so on and so forth. Those are the things that we do just basically to turn the lights on from a human capital perspective. Then we're going to talk about how we build relationships across the organization. And we build relationships through organizational development activities. That's important because that sets the tone for the organization and it sets the culture for the organization. And as all of you know, when we have a great culture, we have employees who like coming to work, who perform their best, and that's good for our community. Then we're going to talk about a few more services that we offer and projects that we're currently working on. We'll talk about challenges that we have, and nothing new to you, I'm sure, when I get to that point. And then we'll round off the conversation today by letting you have an opportunity to hear from a couple of our internal customers. So that's where we're going. When we line up the activities we perform in HR, there are four overarching objectives that we have had as a focal point for the last 2 to 3 years. First is we try to partner with all the departments, the city departments, to make sure that we're providing services that help them achieve their goals and their strategic objectives. Next, we try to do those things that contribute to an engaged workforce. So again, when you have an engaged workforce, you have people that love to come to work, and then the city of Rochester is seen as an employer of choice. Next, as many of you have heard me say many times, we're on a mission to streamline our processes. Many of them have been archaic for a number of years, but I am so pleased to say that in the last 12 to 18 months, we have made such great progress. Thank you to a number of people, but most importantly, thank you to our IT department. And then lastly, having 19 different collective bargaining groups means we spend a fair amount of time in labor relations activities. So, when we talk about core services, in front of you, I have given every one of you, sorry, council members, I didn't bring extra copies, but if others would like a copy, I can get it for them, a copy of the HR dashboard. We complete this HR dashboard every quarter, and so it is a benchmark of those activities that are going on in HR. And it's also a way for us to track and record trends that are going across, that are occurring across the city. So if you look at your benchmark for the year-end 2015, in the upper left-hand corner, you're going to see information relative to workforce demographics. So the first one is, you'll notice that on average throughout the year, we had about 844 full-time employees. That number didn't waver too much. We had part-time seasonal employees anywhere from 404 at year end, up to 596 in the second quarter. It tends to rise a little bit in the second quarter just because we have a lot of employees that come on that help us with our seasonal summer activities. So on average in the city, we cut payroll checks for 1,200 to 1,300 employees, sometimes 1,400 depending on the month. When we have an election year, on top of that, we add another 500 employees, election judges. So that's a lot of transactional work going on in election year, in addition to taking care of our seasonal and full-time employees. Moving along then, under the equal employment opportunity demographics, you will see that we measure the number of minorities that we hire per or relative to the number of positions filled by quarter. So the only quarter that we made headway this year was in the second quarter, where we had 14% of the employees we hired happened to be of minority status. So that would equate to about 2 employees. To help us this year expand our efforts to get more people in relative to people, persons of color, we have now subscribed to Jobs in Rochester. So our reach is going up much further than it has in the past. So we're actively trying to find ways to bring more candidates in to the organization so we have more opportunities to hire and change our diversity number. When you look at the seasonal staff we hire, our overall minority percentage is about 4.3%. So we are making headway, albeit somewhat slow, but we are moving in the right direction. We're trending in the right direction. And then underneath that, you can see that the average age for our full-time employees is about 46. And underneath that, we're showing employee turnover. Our employee turnover in the city of ranks about 4.8%. And about 2.7% of that has to do with retirements. The remaining 2% just comes from employees leaving for other reasons and a few involuntary terminations. So overall, our turnover is very, very low. Anytime it's below 10%, you know that you have low turnover. Average, I would say, is more like 10 to 15%. In the bottom left-hand corner, we measure internal measures. So this is one we're going to talk about again a little bit later. We measure headcount per HR employee. So usually an HR professional in an average HR department would handle about 100 employees. You can see our measurements run for every HR person on our team. We range from anywhere from 141 employees up to 179. That means the HR team that we have carries a 40 to 80% heavier workload than you typically will see in the industry. And I would even guess that in a government organization with 19 bargaining units, the average is probably more close to one HR professional for every 90 employees. So this is a measurement of how much workload we carry. And I'll, again, come back to that in a bit. Other things that we've done, number of policy revisions. We've revised 6 organizational policies, which you've all seen. We've handled 1 arbitration last year, 3 mediation sessions, and the number of grievances that came to a step 3 level were 7, which speaks well for the number of low grievances we have in the city. I think that speaks well to the labor relations relationships we have with our bargaining teams. Up in the right-hand corner, you'll see loss prevention information. This basically has to do with workers' compensation information. The annual claim cost for the year was $438,774. That was trending downward, about $100,000 from where we were a year ago. Number of employees injured, 188, and most of those come in the public safety arena. Total recordable incidences, we had 47 of those. That means of the incidences that happened that were of a serious nature that had to be reported to OSHA, we had 47. Total days away from work, we had 648 missed days of work because of workers' compensation injuries. That equates to 3 full-time equivalents. And also restricted days, meaning people could work, they just couldn't do their existing job. They came in and did light duty, was 683 days. And the number of OSHA examinations, respiratory, random drug testing that the HR team coordinated was 354 for the year. So again, that speaks to activity that goes on in our organization from an HR standpoint. Staffing activity. We posted last year 113 different jobs. That's more than what you typically see relative to the number of positions filled, which is 82, because oftentimes when you post one vacancy, you'll have an internal promotion, which creates a few more postings. So there's always more postings than there are vacancies at the present time. We processed 3,663 applications. We filled 82 positions, and on top of that, we filled 267 part-time seasonal positions. This is a key number because one full-time recruiter usually can handle 45 vacancies a year. We have about 1.5 dedicated people on our HR team to support recruitment. So what I'm sharing here is we don't have enough people to do the recruitment the way it's stated, or we've done it by working extra hours, basically, is what's happened. So that's an area that's really a pinch point for the HR team. We've promoted 30 individuals, so of those 82 vacancies we've had, 30 of them received internal promotions. The remaining 52 were from new people hired that you authorized, or it was from turnover from retirements or other types of departures from the employees. And then speaking of retirements, right below that, you'll see the number of eligible retirements that we had in the organization. This is for full retirement or early retirement. We had, usually we range anywhere from 266 to 287. So of that number, we saw 23 people leave or retire last year, which is a little lower than we typically see. Normally we range from 25 to 35 in the last couple years. And then on the bottom right-hand corner, unemployment data. We processed 44 unemployment claims last year. We had zero hearings that we participated in, and our unemployment costs ran from anywhere from a negative $92, must have had a refund there, up to $22,000. And that's primarily for the seasonal employees that we work with. So these are the basic services that we perform on a day-in and day-out basis for you and for the City of Rochester. So, in addition to that, other services along these same lines that we've completed, we conducted 5 employee investigations. Some of them are done internally by Jennifer and Tim. Sometimes we use an external investigator. We coordinated with the League of Minnesota Cities. We had 2 EEOC complaints last year. One has been resolved, one is still pending. We responded to 116 data requests. A few years ago, we would have been averaging 40 to 50 data requests. So this is a huge number. It's worth noting because it's a considerable takes a considerable amount of time on our part to gather this information. And in addition to that, under Christine's leadership, we have put together an employee benefits team in the City of Rochester that gives us input on medical plan design, dental design, and other benefits that we offer. So we are in the second year of implementing our high deductible plan. Anytime you have a new plan, there's some residual carryover of things to work through. So Christine has done a nice job of leading the team to work through those issues. We are currently also in the process of researching and evaluating our dental plan. About 18 months ago, we did an internal benefits survey with our employees, and the feedback was the plan needs to be modernized. It hasn't really had any major changes since the 80s. So it was time to take a look at it. And then another change under Christine's leadership that we made last year was we moved to a new employee assistance plan provider, one that provides more counseling options and more services, again, at the request of our employees. The Affordable Health Care Act continues to challenge us in some respects. There were new reporting requirements that came into play in 2016. Organizations now have to provide evidence to their employees that we offered coverage to employees that work more than 30 hours a week, and then our employees also have to have evidence that they had insurance. So the challenge that happened this year was the reporting requirement came out from the government ahead of any system design or software design, which made it really challenging to stay ahead of the game. So luckily, we just got under the March 31st deadline by about a week of getting all the information out. We're still working on the second report. So that's been a new challenge for us as well. And then in addition to that, under Kari's leadership, she helped 100 employees approximately deal with FMLA requests. And Christine also worked on 15 ADA accommodation requests last year. So there's a lot of interactive processes that go on with that. Okay, now from an organizational development standpoint. Again, these are the things that we do that build relationships across the city, and that's important because by building relationships, we think we can influence culture in a positive manner. So one of the things we did last year was we conducted an employee engagement survey. Again, when you have highly engaged employees, they give discretionary effort, and that bodes well for the citizens. So in our survey last year, we had a 74% employee response rate. That means out of our 844 employees, about 611 responded. That's a very, very high response rate, which gives credence to the information that was obtained. In the survey, there's 12 dimensions that are measured, and then you get an overall satisfaction score. Our score jumped in 2013 from 75% to 79%. That's a very healthy score, given that many industry averages hover in the 30 or 40%. So we have room to grow, but we're happy with the 79% because moving up 4 percentage points is good growth. On our highest scoring dimensions, the employees told us that they're proud to work for the City of Rochester. They're excited about the future and the growth potential that we have. They would recommend us as an employer of choice, and they're overall pleased. They understand that when they come into work every day, how what they do on a daily basis connects to the overall bigger picture of the city of Rochester. On the low scoring dimensions, they basically said it takes a long time to get decisions made. Sometimes they would like to understand more the rationale behind the decisions, so there's some communication opportunities for us as leaders. And even though we have good cooperation between our departments, they still see opportunities for more cooperation. So that was the low-hanging fruit that came up. So where HR gets involved in the employee engagement survey, other than administrating it, is also that they actively get involved with supervisors across the city, because each department has their own engagement results, and then they action plan around that. Every department's results are slightly different. They take the feedback, and then they address how they can move those scores forward. Moving along, other things that we've done from an organizational development standpoint consist of training and development activities. We're in the process of rolling out a new leadership development program, one that we've been working on for the last 7 or 8 months. It's geared towards senior leaders. It's a very active process, involved process, that the goal is to make sure that we have senior leaders prepared so that when department head level or other senior level positions become available in the city, that they are ready and equipped to apply for them. We invited Ellie Krug in last fall. She's coming back in the spring to do transgender sensitivity training. We've done emotional intelligence training, self-awareness primarily for our employees. And when they understand themselves and understand better, others better, they communicate better, we have better relationships going on in the organization. It's the foundation of how we operate. Jennifer has done some training in the Myers-Briggs personality profile training. She's also going off to become officially certified here soon, so she will be our resident guru on Myers-Briggs. I've become certified in social styles. So while Jennifer's teaching Myers-Briggs, Myers-Briggs is all about how I see myself. Social styles personality profile is about how others see you. And so combined, those two assessments are good overviews for our employees. In addition to that, last year, one of the policies that we changed happened to be the respectful workplace policy. You may recall we brought that forward for your approval, where we talked about civility, incivility, and bullying. And so we decided that was a good training topic. So under Jennifer and Tim's leadership, they went out and probably did 20 or 30 training sessions last year, and they also addressed the topic of harassment. So I think that was a really good training session. It reminds employees about the conduct that we expect to see every day in our work environment. And then lastly, wherever we can, we try to provide strategic planning support. So maybe that's participating in a strategic planning session. Or Jennifer has also participated in leading some SWOT analysis for some of our departments. So it's good involvement. And then lastly, Jennifer has also done team training for some of our departments. So we've done a lot of training. This is an area where if we had more time, we could do more training, because we certainly have the talent in-house to develop it. It just takes time. And so this is a trade-off that sometimes we have to make, because we don't have enough resources to do as much training as we'd like. Okay. So, other services that we have provided. Jennifer and Tim are actively involved in the civil service recruitment process and helping to coordinate monthly meetings that go on with our Civil Service Commission. In police and fire, and in both of those groups, we have worked on developing competency-based models in the fire department for our fire chiefs, and in the police department, I think it was for police officers. And the reason we're developing competency-based models is to make sure that we're looking for the right characteristics when we're hiring individuals. It's an important element of recruitment. Oh, and I should also mention, in the police department, they have implemented a new recruitment strategy to conduct more face-to-face interviews. So that does two things for us. It keeps a very high caliber of list of candidates all year long. And the second thing, by granting more interviews, we hope to attract a larger base of minority applicants into our recruitment process. So we hope that pays off dividends. Performance evaluation. If any of you read HR journals, performance evaluation has been under close scrutiny the last 12 to 18 months. It has here as well. We have streamlined our process, and we may be streamlining it again, and Jennifer takes leadership for that. We had 10 open contracts this past year. 9 of them are closed, and we have 1 remaining open. In 2017, then we have 8 or 9 more contracts to start up again this fall, negotiating. And then our technology projects have certainly taken a long time too, but we're excited about this because we see a lot of forward movement. Under Barb's leadership and Jill Douglas and our team, they have worked on the city's website, external website redesign. Now they're currently working on the city's intranet redesign. So streamlining the process or the web page, intranet page, making it more useful and resourceful for our employees. And so she's working on staff on that. And then probably on one of our larger projects that's been ongoing on the HR department for the last 3 to 4 years is employee self-service. You've heard me talk about this. We've made such great inroads under Kari's leadership this last year. So this is all about having employees have the option of electronically completing documentation to change their benefits information. So previously, if you wanted to change your address, you'd have to physically come up to the HR office, fill out 5 different sheets of paper, and then we'd send it to 5 different organizations. Now, employees under the new scenario can go online, make the changes, and all the information goes right into the system. So we've reduced the amount of paper we're moving around, and we've reduced the staff time of inputting data and sending it out electronically. We've done that with a number of our services, so address changes, emergency contacts, pay advice history, leave accrual balances, auto deposit changes, 457 deferred comp changes, verification of employment, all has now been automated. The biggest part of this next project has been, we've divided it into 3 phases. Phase 3 is coming along, and now we hope to do open enrollment electronically as well, saving lots and lots of paper by mailing it out. Other projects that we're excited about, we also were involved in the laser feature document imaging process, where we electronically took our medical files and our performance evaluation files, and we converted them to electronic format. And I just want to show you a little bit about the efficiency we've gained by doing so. I think it's just kind of a good, interesting tidbit of information. We have basically taken 144,456 sides of paper, reviewed them, sorted them, scanned them, and electronically filed them. That is a half a ton of paper. It costs $25,000 to fill a 4-drawer lateral filing cabinet. We've eliminated several of those in our HR department. Mm. To maintain that 4-drawer filing cabinet costs $2,300 a year. So while we don't generate revenue for the city, we can certainly can help control costs by doing this type of thing. We're about, I would guess, maybe 25 to 30% of the way through moving our paper to electronic format. Other projects that we're working on with Laserfiche, the next one is the onboarding process. So to hire a new employee generally takes 25 to 30% of whatever the employee's new wage will be. That's the cost of recruitment. But in addition to that, the paperwork that gets shuffled just to bring that person in the door generally ranges from anywhere from $100 to $400. I would say ours is on the $400 side of the equation. It takes, right now, we have 25 steps involved with our onboarding process. That's fill out the paperwork so you can start working here. We hope to take those 25 steps and reduce them down to 6 or 8. And by doing such, not only are we making our process more efficient relative to the streamlining of paperwork, but we also hope to create a better image for the city of Rochester so we look modernized in how we bring people on board. And we hope to reduce our costs by 50%. All right. Challenges that we have in the HR department. Well, one of them... Well, I shouldn't say this is a challenge, because we did meet our budget last year. We stayed within our budget guidelines, so that's good news for you and for us as well. But our biggest challenge is still staffing. That 1 to 100 ratio compared to where we're at makes a big difference. When we're operating at 30 to 80% at greater capacity than most teams, we have to make trade-offs, and we're constantly having that conversation in HR. Do I recruit, or do we spend time coaching, developing, training, doing those things that we think have equally... valid value for the organization. So it's difficult for us because you can only run your staff at this capacity so long and they burn out. And we're peaked. We've been peaked for a long time. So in our recommendation, our staffing plan again for this year, I will still ask for an HR consultant. That will be on our list. It was there last year and it's coming again forward this year. In addition to that, I am a big proponent of having an IT analyst. One of the reasons that we made progress this year in HR is because we had more dedicated IT resources than we've ever had before, and it made a huge difference. When we can pair up with IT and move forward. They start to understand our business, what we need to do, and they can help and they can throw out ideas that we wouldn't have thought of not having an IT background. So I don't need a full-time dedicated IT analyst, but when Mr. Martinson comes forward with his request for more IT staff, this makes the world of difference to people in small departments like myself or ourselves who are understaffed. So it's really important. So that's about what we do. That's about how our core services, that's about how we try to enhance the culture of the city of Rochester. Those are important, and you can see why I'm proud of our HR team, because quite frankly, we've gotten a lot done this last year, and I'm very proud of that. But equally important is what our customers think of us. So I've invited three of our customers to tell you from their perspective how the HR department adds value. So with us today is Vance Swisher, Deputy Chief Vance Swisher from the Fire Department. He will go first, then Paul Widman, from the Park and Rec Department, and then he'll be followed up by Eric Kurska. Yep. So, Vance.
Yeah, we don't go out of luck here.
Yeah.
A couple of areas that they've really helped us streamline some things that we kind of want to point out to City Council, not only to help HR, but also help the Fire Department, was Christine Salto, over the last 2 years, has taken a very good close interest on the Fire Department. So the Fire Department's required to do medical screening on an annual basis. Historically, this medical screening has taken us 3 to 4 months to try to schedule everybody, work with the vendor, get it done, stuff like that. Christine put in a number of hours that allow us to streamline this down to 1 month. So we got 98 employees that we have to run through annual medical screening, taking a lot of service time where our staff couldn't go out and do other things because we run this unit. So Chief Martin will talk about here later, but we had one or two people that were off and taking time for us to take that whole unit out of duty to go to a medical screening. Through her help, we were able to get that streamlined. We were able to get it all done basically within 4 weeks and get that moving forward. Not only saving time, I'm sure, for HR, but saving a lot of time and valuable resource time for the fire department. Another thing I want to bring up was some supports and some leadership guidance that has been provided by Jennifer Simpson. As you know, the Fire Marshal's office has asked for staffing for a number of years. As the city continues to grow, we're looking for ways to be more effective and efficient in code enforcement through the development processes that we're seeing. Jennifer has sat down with that Fire Marshal team, gone through a SWOT analysis, trying to identify what are some of the strategies, what are the weaknesses, the areas of threats and stuff like that, moving forward so that they can come forward and be more effective and efficient with the way they do stuff. In addition to the SWOT analysis, Jennifer and then also IT did a Kaizen event forum for the fire marshals, looking at areas they can streamline stuff not only through IT, but also just efficiency and everything like that. A couple other things I want to bring up is areas that Christine has helped us with line of duty injuries, where we have people that are out, they are injured on duty, they're struggling trying to get through some of the paperwork, so not only through fire administration, but through HR, working through that, and also the FMLA leaves. You know, FMLA is a confusing document sometimes, and for a person like Kari to be able to work with our staff to help them understand that, and also help the supervisors understand it, it has allowed us to be more efficient and effective at implementing those type of strategies.
Thank you, Vance. Paul.
Okay. You heard great examples and a great overview of the leadership and resources that HR provides. I just want to give specific examples from a perspective of her best customer, Parks and Recreation. We keep HR busy, but first of all, from a fairly recent example as a candidate coming on board to the city of Rochester. I had a great experience every step of the way. Linda and her team provided great communication and feedback, especially from the time that the offer was made until the time I arrived in Rochester. It seems like I was getting daily emails or phone calls either from HR or from representatives in Parks and Recreation. And I know it was coordinated, but it was a very natural communication process, made it very helpful. When I came on board, there were a lot of things that I found surprising and just a great benefit to the department. One of the first things I did was, I met Tim Comstock. He's the consultant that works directly with the Parks and Recreation Department. Scheduled the first supervisors meeting when I came on board, and Tim was one of the first people to show up in our conference room, and I thought maybe he was at the wrong meeting. But what I found that was a well-established tradition for him to be pretty much embedded in our team, and it is such a great resource to have as we plan and make decisions. He listens and pays attention to things that may have a labor HR implications, and he's very proactive in helping us out. He helps coordinate our training, and we love working with the entire HR team, but having Tim there, he really acts as kind of mediator and sorts through a lot of the work that we do. One of the first times that we had a full-time vacancy and I was part of conducting the recruitment, I was kind of drawing on my past experience thinking I needed to sort through the applications and even get the interview questions ready. Tim was already two or three steps ahead of us, had all that laid out even before I had a chance to even start working on it. We get proactive support like this throughout HR. Anytime there's a workers' comp issue, it's something our supervisors don't deal with on a regular basis, so it's great to have Christine to just kind of walk us through that and give examples of the entire team in that same vein. And any time that there's a change, such as recent benefit changes, Tim has walked us through that. And it's not only with working with our supervisors, he'll take that out to every work group and walk through the process. So we receive excellent support. And again, I came from an environment that was more of a kind of a transactional. You know, you ask for the help when you need it, and it's great to work with a team that are a step ahead of the game. So thanks.
Thank you, Paul. And then last but not least, Battalion Chief.
Hi. For me, the HR adds value because of attitude and professionalism. You just walk through the door, call them. Whenever you stop in, they make you feel welcome. They make you feel valued. And you might be thinking to yourself, well, that's what people are supposed to do. But I can tell you that hasn't always been the case. So they're always a pleasure to work for. Christine and Kari answers my stupid questions almost every day on FMLA and injury. Last year we had the Sirota survey, the employee engagement survey. And going through the results, it became apparent that my team needed or could benefit from some leadership training. Well, there isn't resources in the budget, there isn't resources in the city for that type of soft skills training. So I walked hat in hand up to HR to meet with Jennifer and what can you do for me? And we put together a awesome training program that has been making a huge difference. So for about a little over a year now, we've been doing leadership training with my battalion. And it's working, it's helping, it's making a difference. So my hat's off to this team. They help me every day, the attitude is great. They're so smart, they know what they're doing. And I'll just leave you with this. Often people won't remember what you say, but they always remember how you made them feel. So thank you.
Thank you. All right, I appreciate the glowing comments from all three gentlemen. And so, that concludes my presentation. I'm certainly welcome to take any questions that you may have.
All right, questions or comments from the council? I can start by just saying thank you very much for the presentation. The sense of professional approach to the topic is very obvious, and as indicated, it really is pervasive throughout the organization. It's not just unto itself. You exist to help others with problems, and that is very apparent. So thank you for that. Other questions or comments, Mr. Campbell?
So without saying thanks for the work organization, the one piece about the request for additional staff this year, we are adding a safety manager. I'm just wondering, are we recapturing some time that... Okay.
Yeah. So the numbers will drop slightly, the 40-80% extra workload will start to shift down, but they'll still be high.
Okay. Well, I figured it would be high. I'm just wanted to know if that was captured in the numbers.
It's not. These are 2015 numbers.
Right. Okay. Mm-hmm.
But we will capture that. And thank you so much for the safety administrator. It's gonna make a difference. Hopefully, with some of these worker comp numbers, it'll trend down. So we are ecstatic about getting that player on our team. It's going to make a difference.
All right. Anything else? Ms. Mean.
It's amazing the amount of work that you accomplish with being understaffed and doing it very well. So thank you for that. I did have a couple questions. One is the respectful workforce, the training that you're doing, going out, wrestling and so forth. Is that a required?
It was a mandatory training session.
It was mandatory.
Yeah, we still have a few sessions to offer, I believe. Correct me if I'm wrong, Jennifer. But yes, it was mandatory training for every employee in the city of Manchester.
And do you extend that to the council now?
We have not.
I
think but certainly think about that.
I think that.
Sure.
I think it would be very interesting to see how that training works and how it can impact the way we do business perhaps as well.
That training went very well from the standpoint that it engaged the employees in some really healthy conversations, and it's just good for reminders about what civility in the workplace looks like. So I think it went over very well.
Okay. You had mentioned about the police department and they're doing something different with their recruiting, their face-to-face interview, and that's something new?
Well, more. More candidates are getting in with the face-to-face interview that might have been cut off before through the scoring process. We've changed the scoring process, which means more people will be invited into the interview. So that keeps a perpetual list of high-caliber people. As you know, they hire off of a list. But also, we're hoping by getting more people exposed to the interview, we'll have a chance to tap into a few more minorities than what you would otherwise. So it's just started this year, so the fruits of the labor haven't been calculated yet, but we're hoping it has a positive impact.
Okay, that's good. The minorities hired at 14%, you said it was about 2?
That was for that quarter, right?
For that quarter. So actually it was 2 for the year then?
Okay. Well, we have about a 7 or 8% total minority population in the city of Rochester, Sandra, but the vast majority of that, about 2% is for our full-time employees. The vast majority of our minority population rests in our seasonal temporary employees. We do a pretty good job of recruiting for seasonal temporary employees from that standpoint. We're challenged more on a full-time employee basis, and so that's what we're focusing on.
I recall that we discussed this before, and you were going to reach out, maybe try some new contact sources
yep.
and those kind of things. That's what you want to do.
And that's what we did.
And you did. Oh, mm-hmm.
That's what we're doing.
Well, yep. Thank you for that.
So we just started that a few months ago too, Sandra, so we'll see what kind of impact that has as well.
Thank you.
The other thing to do is go out and physically mine talent or build relationships across the city with different organizations. We'd be happy to do that for you if we had more resources. Right now, we don't have the resources to do that.
I know the campus visits and building that relationship with the campuses, especially mm-hmm. within that 300-mile radius, might be a very positive way to build trust and perhaps build interest as well.
And I suspect that will gain more momentum as the labor market starts to tighten up in Rochester. We've been very fortunate. We still source really healthy numbers for recruitment for the most part. But we aren't seeing the minority levels that we want to see. And I suspect that will change in the next few years.
Great. Thank you.
What does that resource look like? Like, what is there a particular type of position, or is it just general kind of...
I'm asking next year in my budget, you mean?
Yeah. Okay. I mean, specifically to go toward addressing... recruitment.
Well, we could use a full-time recruiter on our team. There's no question about that. I would probably take an HR consultant, and because right now Tim and Jennifer are divided between 6 departments. We have 13.
Yeah.
That means 7 of our departments are going without a dedicated resource. So I would take the recruiting function and probably divide it up a little bit. I think there's a place for senior consultants to spend their time with high-level positions, and then there's this mid-level range that it's hard to jockey back and forth with 80-some positions across the organization.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Appreciate it.
All right. Anyone else?
Well, I appreciate what you folks are doing. And do we know what the adult age minority population is in Rochester? I know that's something I've struggled with for a long time.
I don't know what the adult age is. I do know how many of the minority groups in Rochester, how many are eligible to work, and it's about 10%.
Oh, okay.
Because I actually called Dee, because I've heard the minority populations in Rochester hover between 20 and 25%.
Yeah, right.
And of that 20 and 25%, I've been told about 10% are eligible to work.
Okay.
The rest are children or something of that nature.
I know that's a useful figure because I know that the minority population does not necessarily reflect the minority workforce population
right.
in the community.
Right.
So there's a lot of kids. So appreciate that. And mention that's certainly a challenge when we have 19 bargaining groups. That's how's that process coming? I know we're trying to more and more standardize, normalize the some of the contracts we have between the different groups. Is that
we're getting there.
Is it reaping? We're getting there, but it also is it reaping some rewards for you?
Well,
in terms of
we're still in the process of negotiating one of those. We've gotten a couple of them. What he's talking about is aligning our wage grids. So we have 19 different bargaining groups, and many of them have different wage grids, which doesn't make a lot of sense, and it's very administratively cumbersome. So we've been trying to align those wage grids. We've been making slow progress on them. When you have 2 and 3 year cycles to negotiate, it takes a while to get all the groups through. And some of them will never get totally aligned, but others we've been working on aligning. And it's a good thing for the employees. It doesn't make sense for employees over here to be paid more or less than employees over here doing the same job. So it's coming, I will tell you that.
All right, anything else? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate
report.
It. Mm-hmm.
So thank you.
You're welcome.
Moving on to the fire department. Chief,
I had a brief PowerPoint, but some of the slides are maybe a little difficult, so I'm going to pass these around for you to take a look. And also, while that's going around, we've got a couple of awards on the fire station. Actually, Kurt, did we get a third one? I can't remember the third one.
The third one we haven't received yet.
Yeah.
From Harvard.
This firehouse one, they had the station in Minneapolis, and then they finally corrected it at the Rochester, but now I noticed in the small print it still says Minneapolis for the city, so maybe they'll get it right on the third.
But you're sure they're talking about us?
Yeah.
Actually, the Rochester Fire Department will take over Minneapolis.
Yeah. Well, that's what I told Chief Friedel about the Minneapolis chief.
That's a pension liability I'm not interested in.
I was going to say.
We have the quality of people here today.
Yeah, right.
Just wait till the budget time, right?
Yeah, really. What I've got here is a real brief review from 2015 and kind of a snapshot of 2016, some of our plans. Some of these slides every year I make the rounds with the troops and give them sort of the budget basic information on how our budget's put together, what we asked for, what we got, what we didn't get, what our plans are. And so this is kind of the slides I've passed on to you. First one, I guess I should preface some of these data sheets with a little bit of information. We're in the process of moving over to a new computer-aided dispatch system. With that comes a records package with some advanced data work. And so we're still, I think Kurt and Vance just went to it last week, was it? So they're practicing on you. This first one is response time, but it's normally you would look at response time from when you roll out the door until you get on scene. This particular chart you're looking at includes the turnout time. In other words, how long it takes to get on the fire engine and leave. And by national standards, we have 60 seconds on a medical and 80 seconds on a fire call. You'll see we had a spike in response times in 2013, and then you see it's on a downward trend from 14 and 15. And that's due to a couple of things. Some of it we've changed our run cards. In other words, what station goes to what address, to figure out a little more closely who's the closest, I think. And then also this computer voice that you just heard, that speeds up dispatching by about 30 seconds. We're playing with a couple of voices now, and it's still not quite where we want it, but it does speed up the dispatching. Previous to this, the dispatcher had to push a couple of buttons and to do things. Now, once they accept the recommendation from the CAD by pushing a key, and that's what happens. And prior to that, that you don't hear, there's a pre-alert in the stations with a voice too, so that's shaved some response time off there too, control response time. But a second sheet there, again this is a little bit flawed too, because this includes all calls, and so we go on some code two, or I should say non-emergency calls. Thanks, Vance. some non-emergency calls that don't require lights and sirens response, and some of those are in there. Also, you notice that on the very end, one of our ladder trucks, our two ladder trucks, have some of the longest response times. Well, that's probably because they go on quite a few of the non-emergency calls, either for service or say there's a carbon monoxide alarm with no illness, so no one's sick, so it's not an emergency.
So, catch, help me. What's the number? What's that equate to?
Oh, those are seconds. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Yeah. So you track about a minute for turnout time, and you're getting kind of close to where our profile is, what we're trying to hit there. And again, this is a brand new data analysis package we're working with. So the next one,
right side up.
Yeah. This is kind of a graphic you almost don't need to explain too much, but you can see where our call volume was in 2001, and you can see where it is as of last year. Typically, we're in a 3 to 5% call increase a year. We've had a couple of times already this year where we've had two structure fires at once and nobody available to go. We had a recent structure fire up in Northeast, and while they were there, we had another report of a structure fire out in Northwest on a hotel. The hotel one did not turn out to be anything super significant, but at the same time, a medical call came in, and we didn't have anybody to send. So that's why when you saw last year's budget request, and I'll be like a broken record this year, I desperately need another crew to plug some of those holes. And in terms of volume, we're about on the same pace. Last year we hit about 10,000, runs just under 10,000. If we get a normal 3 to 5% increase, we'll be slightly over 10,000 in calls. This next one, you can stop if you want to talk about any of these in depth. I'll just run through them. This is actually a slide we showed with the troops when we made the rounds on what we accomplished in 2015. We've finished the Century Heights station on budget. We're in the process now first we're looking at the west part of Northwest for a new station location. We've run some computer profiles and some timings out there with various vehicles. Once we kind of get something solidified there, we're going to look at other areas of the city and plan for the future. Cheaper to buy it now than later. And I hope to have a request to you in the next month or so on a site we're looking at in West. The station alerting system, we completed that. You just heard the electronic voice. That was an expensive proposition. The previous system was becoming erratic, and it was impossible to replace it because it was no longer in production. So, and again, it does help our response times. We're working we're getting some estimates for the county to take that system countywide, also with some other automated features. Training, we're working more and more with our county fire departments. County chiefs are working on a plan to do some joint training, mostly involve the volunteer organizations, but we'll be involved. We did have trying to work on a gas prop that one of the Minnesota Energy was going to give to the county out of the training site. They just couldn't work out the details, so we had to pass on that, or the county did. We were very much supportive of it. One of the things that's kind of a fire department thing, but also an emergency management issue, is the MOU where Rochester Township and Cascade Township, if something were to happen to one of our stations, we have an MOU with them to temporarily use our facilities as a fire station. Again, now that we have those in place, we'll never need them, so that's how it goes with prevention, I think. So that was a positive. We still have, we're waiting for a dispatch in the future at for Rochester Police to move in there. I haven't spoken to them recently about that, but I'm sure that's coming up in the next year or so. The second last one is kind of interesting. Many organizations have committees. We call them groups instead of committees, and it's kind of based on the premise that the people doing the work out there in the field should have some input and say so on what some of our practices are, what equipment we buy, those types of things. And we have a process where partially part of this process is stolen from the U.S. Army. thanks to Eric Kurska. Part of it's stolen from Mayo Clinic. And so we have a process where they can bring an idea forward, and if it's anything that's sort of complicated, it would come to, they would also provide an SBAR, which would talk about the situation, the background, the analysis, and what the recommendation is to decide if we want to move forward on that. So some of our standing groups are apparatus, equipment. We have one on the computer-aided dispatch. What else am I missing? We have an employee relations group, which is just helps provide input on anything that's bugging them, basically. If they want to know about something, well, why did this happen? And so we meet with them, try to get them answers. They had some questions on how we were delivering certain aspects of training here several months ago. So the command staff came in and met with them and explained it. And it led to some minor changes in our practices. So we try to keep the folks out there doing the tasks involved in how we do them. And then I think I've talked about the CAD already, but that's another thing there. It's in progress. We're working on a fleet plan, as you may recall from budget this year, that we have a bunch of apparatus to replace in the coming year. So we're figuring out what type, how much, and when. We've had a couple of meetings with finance on that. Next one is a standardized national best practices policy procedure manual. We're taking a look at that, looking at some other state-of-the-art things to see if it would apply here. I'm just going to jump through these. We have, again, we're looking at the station location and land acquisition. Again, that's just an in-progress planning function we're doing. We still own, and I think the city, I should say, I think fire, maybe police has some old VHF radio frequencies. And we use that for emergency paging and as well as callback. We have put some of the extra radios in the station, so if we ever were to have a catastrophic failure, we'd have something available. So again, it's not something that's a high priority, not something we want to spend a lot of money on, but it is a nice package to have. And then Ken will talk about emergency management. Coming up in the coming year, we have two firefighters in the budget, and I'll come back to you with a plan. I'd like to hire a third one, but not ask you for money. I'd like to be able to figure out how to pay for it by trimming some overtime and some other personnel expenses. The reason for the three is it helps balance the shifts, so you have an equal number on every shift, so it prevents one shift from having to incur overtime. Same concept. We're getting to the point with development where we're going to need a full-time fire marshal. Vance is filling that role with about 20-25% of his time, but it's just we're getting behind from time to time on projects and approvals. And we'd like to do that without asking for funding. We haven't updated our fees for about 15 years, so we'll come back with a plan for you to look at in that. We have a vacant clerical position that we'll be filling. Continue working and our fleet and with our groups. Got the right one. We have a video conference system. I think Public Works uses the same brand or the same concept at least. Some of our equipment's obsolete, so we're in a plan to replace some of that. The New World stuff is our updates on our computer-aided dispatch and records. We have a small remodel to make it a little friendlier, a little more secure when you walk into fire administration. We're going to do some update there. Thanks to you, we have the CIP to update our existing stations. Last year, with that $50,000 that was in our CIP, we replaced the kitchen at Station 1 and some tile at Station 3 were the big projects. This year, we had a We moved the washer and dryer out of the living quarters. The turnoff washer and dryer is a health and safety issue. What else did we do so far?
It's been safety related. Yeah, concrete out front.
Concrete at Station 1. We're replacing, as an energy saving, we're kind of doing a trial. We're replacing the fluorescent lights at Station 4 with the new LED, like swapping out the ends and getting rid of the ballast. And I think that's complete now. I don't know if the truck bay's done, but we've got substantially complete, and then we're going to take a look at the bills and see what it costs. So we're doing that in-house, so that saves quite a bit of money. I spoke to you about looking at some land for Station 6 and maybe a Station 7, that we're going to start looking at south and southeast. Equipment replacement, I'll give you a little snapshot there of one more slide after that. Just, and again, this isn't our full plan, but we're looking at some options to, we have four engines to replace coming up. One model, we got a couple more of another model, seven total. Ladder trucks. We did a pilot program running the rescues on medical calls instead of taking a ladder truck when they were unavailable. Our intent, and that portion worked okay, our intent was to be able to share some workload among the crews, but because of our computer-aided dispatch, it doesn't rotate them properly, so I think that's going to be in the new upgrade, so we may try some things with that. And then we have we call it Rescue 52, but it's part of the state asset called the State Structural Collapse Team, and we have a vehicle they bought for us, eight, nine, 10 years ago, and those are up for a replacement. That's going to be replaced with state money. And as well as this year, we had our equipment replacement fund money for a heavy-duty pickup to tow one of the trailers associated with this team. We were successful in asking the task force to pay for that, so they're paying for that. Save us some money there. So there's just kind of some of the things we're looking at in the future.
Chief, yes? On the top three vehicles, what's the rough price tag on those?
I'm glad you're seated. I'm glad you're seated. $400,000 to $500,000 on an engine. Yeah.
First ladder we replaced probably about $1.2 million.
Yeah.
Second one would be a little less because we saved some of the existing equipment on it.
Yeah.
So a total project price $6 million. All this apparatus is due in 2018, 2019, 2020. Obviously, the city isn't in a position to buy that much apparatus at once. So that's why we're working with finance to come up with a financing scheme that we'll be presenting to city administration and council while we're here on how to get this done.
I think in all likelihood, in certain vehicles, we're going to have to stretch out that replacement schedule.
Mr. Hickey.
And Chief, I think in the past we talked about vehicles, and there's some, recoup some of the cost if you sell the existing vehicles. I mean, it's obviously...
It's pretty nominal.
Okay.
The market for... a used ladder truck without a pump is very low,
okay.
And even in particular with us, when we're done with an engine, it's
used.
About 10 years, you get half the original purchase price from it. These engines, by the time we're done with them, we're going to have almost 25 years on them.
Okay.
So
yep.
We're going 5 to 8 years beyond their original projected lifespan. The trucks are holding up well, so we've got very good mechanic staff. That's been doing it, but we're going to be pushing them right to the end of their useful life.
Yeah.
There's not going to be much left.
For example, one of our reserve engines is a 1993 that, you know, if you look just at the calendar, we should replace it. But it went into reserve early in its life, and we use it as a reserve engine, and it's also a nice vehicle to train recruits on, so we've hung on to that one, just as a practical matter. So we don't, I mean, the age is certainly very important, but you also have to look at the use of a specific vehicle.
Mr. Campion.
So I'm glad to hear the acknowledgement that, you know, $6 million over 3 years is going to be a pretty big lift. But the other part is, part of the plan that's coming back, are we looking at the pacing of acquisition for some of these assets that are a huge capital investment?
Yeah, we're going to try and avoid what we have now.
I hated to beat around the bush, but I'm glad to hear that.
Because we got to the point on both of these top two where, you know, we had to do something.
Yeah.
And we're trying to avoid that by maybe stretching out the life on some of these so we don't get hit with this in the future.
Okay.
Yeah. I guess I should have stated that, but thanks for asking. Yeah. A couple of other minor things, and I'll take any questions. We have a department strategic plan. You know, we continually update that, and we're adding a few things there. One of those is the clock tower project. That's we're going to fund that with donations. Still waiting on a few details. We'll probably try and do, I think we may have another slide on it somewhere, but maybe I'll wait. So we're going to try and do a kickoff sometime in June. Looks like the primary mode of funding will be some pavers similar to the veterans where you can buy an expensive favor and have a limited characters, probably be selling some challenge coins too as part of that. I think the city's investment in the project, if all of this comes together, is would be the professional fees, which is in about $30,000 range, I would guess. We have a $100,000 match, and we have until the end of 2017 to match that, to get that $100,000. So I think we should be in pretty good shape.
Would it be appropriate to mention Alan Calavano?
Yes. Many of you know Alan Calavano was the representative of our anonymous donor, and he passed away. But I did get another call, so that money is still available to us. So we're lined up to do some work that very next week and on a couple of things. And most of us on the group had no idea he was even sick. He kept it very quiet. I did go to the funeral, just a very nice service that I think honored him very well for all of his contributions to the history of Rochester. But
Mr. Ruskin?
Just as a tie into this, I know it's a separate subject of a different day, but when we do this, I'd like us to do some type of acknowledgement for his work and dedication and contributions to this.
Yes.
Something I'd like us to make sure we incorporate in it.
Couldn't agree more. We have already had a couple of discussions with our rep from the foundation on this. So,
okay.
Yeah. And just the only other thing, I had a couple of things I already told you about the clock, but just to give you a little background on our structural collapse team, there's five of us in this group. Minneapolis, St. Paul, Rochester, Edina, and Dakota County, which represents about 11 departments. So there's five members there. Right now, one of our battalion chiefs is serving as a temporary administrator for this, and we're getting all of our costs reimbursed, as well as even the vehicle that he drives. And so that's working well. We still have to actually sign an MOU on this, myself and one of the St. Paul assistant chiefs and Minneapolis assistant chiefs have been through this agreement, so we're trying to get that wrapped up and back to signature to kind of clean that up. We do have an identified funding stream, so it looks like we're in good shape for the future. But we're just trying to clean up a lot of the administrative details, and it's taken way longer than it should have, but I think we're getting closer. And that's a good, not only state asset, but you know, we've used them here locally from time to time when we've had cars run into buildings, and there's questions about the stability of the building. And we've had a few of those. I think we had a deployment down to Iowa 5 or 6 years ago. I think it was 7 years ago, actually, to do search and rescue on one of their floods. So it's a great asset to have, and the kind of asset you don't want to ever go on any calls either, because something terrible has happened when they go out the doors. So that's kind of a quick snapshot of 15 and 16. I think I already talked about the clock tower there. And so we're in good shape to kick that thing off and hopefully make it happen. So, questions? I got all the experts here. I can't answer it.
Well, once again, I will start off by thanking you also for the annual report. This is very helpful to work more relaxed than trying to push all this stuff through during the midst of a budget request.
Yes.
So thank you for that and the insight into the operations and some of the things that, the department is up to. With that, other questions, comments from council? Mr. Ruskin?
I just throw out, back in my early days, and Stephen and Gary and Terry and some of remember this, but we used to have a lot of issues with the fire department, and now the only issues we ever hear are positive ones. I mean, we only have, you know, the only thing I ever hear is people really pleased with the service and really pleased with the efficiency and the way that it's handled. And so, with that, you know, these numbers are all impressive, but you know, to you and all of your leadership, it's not just about, you know, I know it's about leadership as far as the chief, but it's also about people that work together and care about the overall good, and it's certainly acknowledged and noticed by me and hopefully by others on what you guys are doing. So
well, I really appreciate that. You know, we're the fire service and Rochester Fire is a family, and we have our squabbles and disagreements, and you know, I encourage my staff to argue with me, and I know the battalion chiefs have good arguments with their captains and staff, but they're productive. You know, they're productive. They're not arguing or criticizing for the sake of criticism. It's all we're on the same page in that we want to do things better and more effectively. And so, you know, we do encourage a lot of discussion, and I think we get a lot of input back up through the chain that way. And, you know, we're certainly not perfect, but we're trying to do our best.
Well, and I think it's being handled the right way, whatever is being done, and so I just thank you.
Thank you.
Champion.
In my household, it's a tight race between the police department, the fire department, and my son's heart, so I completely understand.
What's your address?
Right.
Bring him over, I'll change your order.
You know, the one thing that has come up a number of times is the value of being ahead legislatively mm-hmm. for legislation that's going to set us up for an economically affordable fire and police response. And I'm just wondering, you know, in the pipeline of state legislation, is there things that the city should be advocating for in ways that are going to help to, you know, maintain our ability to afford the fire department? Is that something your department keeps tabs on?
Well, like everybody, I've got opinions. I mean, the state chiefs, you know, monitor some of that. We have a firm that runs the state chiefs organization. I'd like to see some state funding. Now, this is really pie in the sky, some state funding for government buildings. Many other states have a formula where, you know, you protect, like I was in Lansing, Michigan, the state capital, a bazillion state buildings, and there was a formula where they pay for fire protection. You know, some of those things would be helpful.
That's called an impact fee.
I know.
And we don't have those.
Let's fix that.
Parkland dedication.
Well, maybe, that's development. This is not development, though. This is
maybe rather than putting you on the spot, I guess what I would offer, and I hope the rest of the council would join me, that if there are things, I think we would be interested to get you know, awareness of legislative topics that are coming up where,
sure,
you know, maybe by passing a resolution we can show some support for ways of reducing the cost. Because I think, you know, we keep looking, and I'm really appreciative of trying to find some financing ways to get out of some of these problems. But you do run one of the expensive departments of the city, and we continue to kind of try and figure out how to stretch those dollars further, just like every department. So that any assistance you can give us in that regard, I think, would be appreciated.
Ms. Main.
I'm so proud to live in Rochester with such an excellent fire and police department, and can always count on good response and good treatment. And I just thank all of you for what you do. It's amazing the kind of situations that you are involved in. And when I see them, it just makes me full to think about how you risk your lives sometimes to protect others. So thank you for your service.
Well, thank you very much.
Mr. Bilderback. Chief, one of the things I've noticed is the congestion of traffic down on South Broadway. I've watched your fire trucks try to get through that. We know the traffic is at this rate and they're going to continue to get bigger. What do you think we can do to start? Because this is going to affect your response times.
Sure. I mean, there's, you know, look at some profiles on a four-minute response time. That's from going out the door to getting unseen. And more congestion and more density means that four-minute is going to be a smaller profile. And so then with a smaller profile, we're not going to get there as quickly. Or you build more stations to be more strategically located. So, you know, it's a balancing act. I mean, we've seen this coming for years, so I don't really have any answers for you. It's just that the density will slow us down, and the volume. I mean, on the fire side, you know, we do have some advantages in that just about everything has built-in fire protection and alarm systems. Rochester has been a leader in the state, and probably in the nation, in that arena, so that's real positive. But on medical calls, that the longer the time, the larger the chance for a bad outcome on a medical call. So,
and our fire, our police do an excellent job. They're easy to criticize because they're very visible, and they're out there all the time.
but I've had the opportunity to be there with our fire and our police when they've had to make responses. And I will tell you that we are very fortunate to have the people that we have. And I will say as well as to our fire department who are willing to work with our independent, our homeowners, as well as our neighborhoods and as well as our businesses. They're right there to put on programs and do educational pieces for these different groups. They've always gone out of their way to do that. So it's easy to criticize, easy to take shots at them because they're very, very visible. But we're very fortunate to have the public service groups that we do to protect our community.
Yeah, we have a good relationship with the police department, and we work hand-in-hand on a daily basis. They're probably our second favorite department in the city.
We've said it before, we keep, and then we just kind of pass by it, but Rochester is very, very lucky with our police and fire. We have one of the top, if not the top, saves when people need medicals with the people that we have in the development that they use with Dr. White from Mayo Emergency Department. They put that program on the map, and it's still on the map, and it's still very high. So our police and fire, how many times, and we've gone through this before, the fire department gets to a medical scene first, how many times?
I think we delivered, Steve, help my memory here, about 40-some percent of the initial shocks.
Just shy.
Yeah, just shy of, which is good, because if we were delivering a very low number, that means that we're not getting there in time. And,
it's pretty remarkable when you start looking at the saves and what our folks do. So. Thank you.
All right.
Thank
you
very much.
Thank you once again. Moving on to our final topic this afternoon, the housing consultant proposal. You'll recall a couple of weeks ago we saw a rough proposal, and we have some questions. Just went along.
Ken, were you planning on doing that? Yeah, I think Ken's planning on doing something too.
Oh, I'm sorry.
He said, these presentations always take longer than you think. And so I'll try to be as quick as I can because I think everybody's here for me to say that.
Situational awareness.
Let me just be brief on these things. I know I'll sound smart if I'm pessimistic. I read this. This is written by Tom Gardner. He's one of the Motley Fool folks. And he was just talking about how pessimism really seems to work. But in my view, from emergency management, I don't think it does us any good for me to say that the sky is falling. To me, I think of myself in the solutions business in terms of trying to be better prepared. You wanted an overview of notable accomplishments in 2015. I think it helps to give a foundation of emergency management to give us some perspective. What are the goals and activities for 2016? A lot of 2015 was spent working on a full-scale exercise. It was the airport's triennial exercise. And the first thing we do is we kind of look at what our hazards are and what have other people experienced, what could we experience. 2 months after 9/11, a plane took off from JFK and crashed in a neighborhood in Queens. Is it terrorism? It's just 2 months after the planes flew into the World Trade Center. You can take a look at something like this and you can say we have fire operations to go on, but we also have people who are probably unaccounted for. We've got family members that need to be taken care of, plus we have the identification of remains. All kind of morbid things when you think about it, but it really fits into the sort of things that it's a tragedy. Could it happen here? What do we need to do to prepare for? This is the exercise that we did. It turned out to be kind of big and complex. We had six different core capabilities that we tested or evaluated, and six different objectives that went with it. But just let me pick out a couple of things from this. Can we identify the remains of people who are hurt or killed? We involved the Southern Minnesota Regional Medical Examiner's Office. They got involved with doing fatality management services and did a great job.
can we take care of victims' families? We worked with the Red Cross and with the airlines to work on our family assistance center operations. What could we do? Can we activate the ELC? Are first responders able to speak directly to each other with radios over a wide geographic area? Do first responders work well together and coordinate in an effective manner? We want to make sure that the police, the fire department, Gold Cross, airport fire, that all those groups could work together. Can we communicate with one voice and one message? Public information is a real big thing that we pushed in this particular exercise to be more effective. And can we effectively mix old and new communications? You know, I'm not very good at social media, but I at least know it's a wave of the future. It's a way that a lot of people get information. How can we incorporate those things into our exercise? So here's the neat stuff, the photogenic stuff. We had students from the paramedic program and nursing program that were involved with this. We had the local media that came out and covered it that day and were part of the press corps, as well as some of the public information officers from the Mayo Health Systems. We had Gold Cross Ambulance that was involved. The simulation center from Mayo Clinic provided some mannequins for us that we could actually tear up and make into body parts that we could use for victim identification. We had a group of public officials that came together to do a press conference for us to give us some practice at doing that. Here's the fatality management group that was out there in the field. Exercise ended at 2 o'clock. At 2:45, we had to kick them off the field. The exercise ended 45 minutes before, but they enjoyed what they were doing so much in a real life setting to go out and practice these things. Here's just a nice picture of the flame simulator that we had that burned some fuel and made some nice flame and made it look really good. Have it down as honorable mention, but really there were a couple of cool things that happened. Echo Minnesota works with foreign language groups. We were the first in the nation to issue some foreign language alerts using IPAWS. That's the integrated public alert and warning system that sends messages over EAS as well as to the cell phones. We've had that system since 2012. Gave us the opportunity to do a live test. That was really neat. We also worked with KTTC, KSMQ, KROC, looks like KAAL. Afterwards, I found out that they were overlooked, which really bummed me out. But we updated their broadcast equipment to the new EAS signal, which allowed us to be able to do that foreign language transmission that went through there. On the public information site, there were a couple of things. It was a really collaborative venture with the Southeast Minnesota Healthcare Coalition, Mayo Clinic, and us. We all put money into this to make it work. We did a very, very elaborate public information improvement program where we did, this report is a result of it, but we did some training, we did an exercise. There was a plane review of all the plans in Southeast Minnesota, health department plans, hospital plans, emergency management plans for plane improvement. Another thing that came out of this was Airport Improvement Magazine called us up and said, we heard that you did this really neat social media thing. Could we feature you in an article? That was nice. And then following up with that, some researchers associated with North Dakota State University, their flight program, actually did a study. And here's a picture of our exercise on the front of their study. And they had six different airports that they took a look at. The number one airport they examined and talked about was Rochester International Airport. So that was really neat. I'll be joining the Southeast Minnesota Disaster Healthcare Coalition with a national conference presentation in December, so that's another nice outcome. Two views of emergency management. I look at being a conductor and coordination. Here are the four phases of emergency management that we always talk about. Preparedness is planning, training, exercising, response, recovery, and mitigation. Mm-hmm. So with that, here's all these activities. There are three priorities that we aim for: life safety, incident stabilization, and property conservation. But even within that, there are, I just found this fascinating. There was a Gallup poll article that they sent it to me and said, could you help college graduates tell us what the three things that the city of Rochester depends upon you for? Not anybody else, but what do they depend upon you for? Well, I think it's kind of a shared thing in many ways, but I looked at it as situational assessment, because if I don't know what's going on, we can't send out that IPAWS alert that will be out to all the residents, the travelers, to let them know that we've got danger. Of course, we need effective disaster management response, and we need coordinated recovery operations. So the sort of things that, I wanted to give a shout out to the Parks Department. They're really moving along with the Quarry Hill Safe Shelter. They're adding it onto a building. If you take a look at it, this is really kind of neat. Everybody gets excited about only, I guess, an emergency manager can get excited about this. These are windows.
I get excited about that, Ken.
This is a tornado shelter. This will be the only tornado shelter in Minnesota that has windows with it. It's also with the other structure, so it kind of adds some more functionality to Quarry Hill. And we also installed a voice modulator siren in Quarry Hill. And because I don't know where all the trails are, it's kind of up in this area right here where that siren is. There's going to be a radio control operation so that in the off hours, a lot of tornadoes happen in the evenings, could be on the weekend, if a tornado comes through and we activate that siren or voice modulator, it opens up the door so people have a place to go to shelter. Of course, we need to be vigilant and make sure that we warn people early enough that they can get out of there. But in case something comes up very quickly, we've got that. Training and exercises in 2016, and I know that Nancy needs to prepare, so let me just talk about some of the challenges that we have. The city of Rochester reminds me of the universe. The universe is constantly expanding. Scientists find that galaxies are moving further away. So are our departments. I know that we need to work together, but I constantly find that as departments, it's a challenge for me in emergency management to bring us all together. We just seem to be working more and more apart. Public alert and warning got thrown for a loop here about a week ago. My vision of this is that we do public alert and warning in different phases. We need the initial alert to go out if we have a train derailment or something that happens, followed by emergency management stepping in and doing alerts. And then finally, we get together this group of public information officers that we trained with this last year to make sure that we can continue on giving out the messages. But those initial alerts, if they come from dispatch, I think that that's where it's most effective. Dispatch has told me that they really are not interested in doing that and won't be doing it at all. So we need to find a way around that to make sure that we can do effective warnings. Related to the EOP, we've got a number of things that we need to do. Damage assessment procedure, the debris management plan, we really have to expand it beyond its current capability. EOP in July, we're going to have the COOP folks that work with us from Bold Planning come in. We're going to migrate our EOP from its currently paper format to an electronic format. And finally, mass care services. We need to develop a family assistance procedure and also the shelter. So I think that recovery operations is really our focus for this year. It kind of dovetails into emergency operations, but we want to do an exercise with our residential care programs like Hiawatha Homes to make sure that we have those things covered. So I tried to be as quick as I could. Thank you very much.
I appreciate that. Questions for Ken? Thank you as well for the update. It's always good to see. It's one of those things we don't think about until we need it, and so it's encouraging to see all of the preparation and work that goes into this to keep us safe and prepared for the time. Mr. Bildebeck, do you want to make any comments? I talk about it all the time. All right, anyone else? All right, well, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
All right, now, no other fire department report. <All right>. Okay, now we will move on to our final topic, which is a review of the housing consultant proposal. I think we had several questions after we saw the initial proposal presentation back on April 18th, and we asked staff to come back with some commentary that's in our packet, but I assume Ms. Baker, do you want to highlight some things for us?
I do. There's a handout coming around. This is just the original comments from Cornerstone, which were intended to be in your packet, along with some excerpts from the LDM, the Development Manual, for your information. So you have two memos in your packet from us. The first is responding to this memo from, or this suggestion from Cornerstone Partnership, in which there were some suggestions on changes to specifically the city's incentive development regulations and how that could perhaps benefit affordable housing. And we went through and did an assessment on what their recommendations were. A number of the things that they suggested are already in place, so I think there was just maybe some misunderstanding about what we do and don't have in place to begin with. There were some suggestions about removing certain criteria from the ordinance. I think it's important to note that the purpose statement for incentive developments is actually on the first page of the first memo there. And it isn't focused solely on inducing affordable housing. There are other broader benefits to the community for having incentive developments and having that flexibility in your land use and zoning regulations. So some of the suggestions might have could result in removing some of the benefit you get in other developments. So I'm not so sure that that's really in the public interest to do that.
Which ones?
We'll go through. Okay. The sheet is actually page 3 in your packet. So our staff went through each of the a number of these specific comments and made or provided a response to those. So I can take as much time or as little time as you'd like. If you want, we can read through each one. Okay. And Jeff Ellerbush and Dave Dunn are here in the room too, and they've helped put some of these materials together. So the first one was to require observation decks or rooftop terraces provided to be open to the general public and include places to eat if they are to be considered a future deserving bonus consideration. There may be other benefits to having rooftop terraces, and I'm not sure that I understand a public purpose in requiring a rooftop terrace to be open to the general public, especially if that's intended to be a benefit in a recreational space, an open space for the residents of a building. Requiring that dining places be included with that, I'm not sure how that helps induce affordable housing or what the tangible connection really is. The second one was require the provision of common open space to be considered an amenity worth bonus if it is available to the general public. Again, I don't understand how that helps to induce the development of additional affordable housing units. The common open space can have benefits, again, for the residents that are there. And if there is additional open space that opens view sheds, it allows for continued views and vistas. There are benefits that come to people who are not on the property, too. So, again, they're bigger and broader. Land use and development policies and benefits, consequences to think about. I just didn't see the tangible piece to that either. So only allow streetscape improvements to qualify for inclusion as a bonus criteria if they go above requirements and include public amenities such as shade and sitting areas. The fact is that most streetscape improvements include shade benefits with both our trees and tree plantings, in more urban settings, street furnishings are often also a part of them. So they're pretty well covered already in our existing policies. D, stormwater management. Rochester has stormwater management utility and stormwater runoff standards already addressed what Cornerstone had suggested. E, the land subject to floodways on a project must provide public easement and maintain the site and trailway in good condition for public use. The city has a pretty sophisticated approach to managing stormwater and flood control projects and public amenities and trails. Unless we've identified some major weakness in the city's policy, again, I don't see the need for this, but I also don't understand the tangible connection to inducing more affordable housing. Suggests beefing up energy conservation requirements such as installing HVAC systems for all residential development. The criteria has recommended design features applicable to site planning rather than insulation in HVAC systems, which is actually a building code requirement. So that is actually more of a building code requirement than it is a zoning requirement. You could consider incentives for maybe energy efficiency and some of these other features that could go with projects. But again, I'm not certain that there's a direct result in inducing additional affordable housing and what that would be. So that's that memo. The next memo is intended to address specifically the conversation the council had about entertaining a proposal from Cornerstone to evaluate inclusionary housing policies for Rochester. We simply gathered some information to give you a little bit broader understanding of what inclusionary policies are and what they could include, so that you have a more informed platform in which to go ahead with your discussions about whether or not you want to hire a consultant for that. First and foremost, I think it's very important to recognize that even though Rochester doesn't have policies that we label as inclusionary housing policies, we do have policies that fit within that realm. And if you take a look at the handout I just gave you, there's really a continuum when it comes to public policy. And on the far left side, you have things as simple and voluntary as educating and promoting. And you go to the far end of the other side of that spectrum where you have requirements and mandates. If you look at the far left side, educate and promote, there are public, nonprofit, and private entities that do some of those things. There may be more need for community conversation around the need for affordable housing. Some of that's being done by HRA, by Minnesota Greater Housing Fund, and by the Rochester Area Foundation. And there's certainly public sector communication around that from the planning department. City administration regularly gets involved in that conversation, especially with TIF projects. The next one is enable and allow. And this is where Rochester has a long history of having fairly flexible lot sizes, having flexibility with home and unit sizes and dwelling types. Our low-density residential zoning districts allow for townhomes, twin homes, duplexes, smaller lot sizes, 6,000 square foot for a minimum single family lot size, then also going down even smaller when you have twin homes and so forth. There, I was reminded today of some history in Rochester of affordable housing developments in which the city actually changed some of the policies to allow for single-family attached dwellings to be built on 30-foot wide lots to increase the stock of affordable housing units in the community. That has been a strategy that's been used in the past. Other strategies have been to develop homes that have unfinished spaces within them, basements in particular, or homes that don't have garages. But again, there's also the other types of dwelling units that contribute to this and a history of being flexible with those too. So you have incentive and non-financial incentives, offering bonuses for density or number of units, additional floor area ratio, and also an example would be to reduce parking, reducing the cost for, especially if it's below grade parking or on-site parking. The next in this continuum, if you will, would be the financial assistance and subsidies. The city has a long history of using TIF. I can't speak to the quantifying the dollars there, but I think Gary's quite familiar with the city's history in that realm. There are other public and or nonprofit financial subsidies that can be offered, including bonding, tax credits, and levy contributions toward projects. And then, of course, you go to the next box would be the requirement or the mandate, and that is typically where an inclusionary zoning, again, just inclusionary policy can cover the whole spectrum, but inclusionary zoning typically then requires a certain percentage of units within a project to be below a certain threshold for affordability. There are some communities that would require, if the units are not built into the project, that a fee in lieu be paid. And that's something that's come up in the past. So we did provide you with some additional information. Kind of going through that spectrum, some of these things are covered. There are some communities in Minnesota that have had some levels and types of inclusionary policies in the past. And some have adopted, implemented, and then went back and retracted some of what they had in place. We've made several attempts to contact folks at the city of Minneapolis and left messages with the people that we need to speak with there. Haven't been able to speak with anybody in person. We understand that they are entertaining some type of inclusionary housing policy, but that it's tied up in committee somewhere. If we can find out some additional information on that, we'll get to the details of the past that I want for you as well. So just some additional perspectives on inclusionary policy provided here for you. One comes from an academic assessment from the University of Minnesota Center for Urban and Regional Affairs. Another is from the National Association of Home Builders perspective, another from a blogger who is very active in primarily in transportation and urban development policy, speaking to the subject as well. If the council decides that you're interested in some kind of study going forward in the future to look at these policies, I think it's going to be really important to define what exactly you want out of this, what you want studied. But the other factor to keep in mind is if you're looking specifically at inclusionary policies in that full spectrum of them, we should save time in that conversation for the pros and cons and looking at that from the broader perspective of community interests and community development as well. I'm happy to try to answer questions or can call up staff who might have more details for you.
Sure. Well, in the interest of time, let's just go right to the questions and see if we can work our way through this. Who wants to start?
So one of the things, so a number of times you mentioned that you didn't see the connection between these bonuses or some of them potentially being counterproductive. And I think that my understanding what the Cornerstone Partnership and others are saying is some of these things that are either being done otherwise or potentially counterproductive, for example, additional setbacks, that those be eliminated and in place of that affordable units would be included. I mean, are we just understanding that one wrong? But that was kind of my intent was, I believe we're trying to pull out some of those things that qualify for incentive and replace it with something that's more meaningful to the community.
I guess the question of what's more meaningful to the community is one to be asked and answered. Yeah. I don't have the answer for it.
Okay. So the recommendation from the Greater Minnesota Housing, the HRA, and the Area Foundation, as well as my own, was to start working on an inclusionary zoning ordinance. Staff is not supporting that at this point.
Well, I would back up just a moment because we have representatives in the room from the HRA. Yep. My understanding is that the HRA has not made recommendation for an inclusionary zoning policy, and they can speak to that.
I think that there is maybe some confusion about what the HRA is doing. Mm-hmm. And I made some notes here from the report, but the HRA is not making planning policy. It's not going to do that. And I wanted to also make, I mean, that's really your job. That's the city's thing. The HRA is not going to do planning policy. And second thing I was thinking about is to maybe make it clear what is the relationship between the HRA and the Greater Minnesota Housing Fund that I think has gotten a little bit confused. HRA did not hire the Greater Minnesota Housing Fund, and the report that they came to us, they were interested in what we were going to do, they offered their expertise, they offered their experience, and they offered to write this report. We're not writing that report with them. So when they do make that report, I just want to make it clear for you that that's their report and that we didn't hire them to do that. So I thought it might be good to bring that up at this point for you in case that there was some confusion about that. Did I state that clear enough? Okay.
So you're speaking as the HRA, as the board itself, and not necessarily as the staff that was involved with the planning? Because we had a presentation here where we came up with a group, a list of next steps.
Yep.
And that was one of the next steps, and that was based on Cheryl's technical expertise. And you're saying that she can provide technical expertise, but it's not a recommendation unless the county board says it is? Or because you are the official HRA?
There is staff here, too, from the HRA, and they can speak to them.
I'm not sure about your question, Mike, and I want to...
Well, I'm just struggling a little bit here because we're, we got these groups together to make some recommendations, and that was one of the recommendations we were making as a group.
I understand that.
Okay.
I just want to make sure that you understand, as this happens, that there's a difference between the HRA and the Greater Minnesota Housing is that we're not attached at the hip. Would that be the way to say it? Not sure, Mitch.
Mitch is here from the word.
Yes, yeah, Mitch is here from the HRA. My name is Michelle Marksbauer. I'm the Housing Program Manager for the HRA. Cheryl is unable to join us here today and asked me to come and represent staff for the HRA. Commissioner Pajolpi is correct. As an HRA, we have not made the stance to move forward or approve a zoning policy for inclusionary housing. What Cheryl has been a part of as part of the ongoing discussion with Greater Minnesota Housing, with Rochester Air Foundation, is as one voice, as part of a group, to look at what options out there exist for affordable housing in our community. The conversation of inclusionary housing did come up. The HRA nor staff has not made any recommendation to endorse this, to encourage this, as anything other than looking at the communication and the ongoing conversation about this. Neither Cheryl or I are city planners. We do not have the expertise in inclusionary zoning. And so anything that we would do to write such a policy would be to look at outside organizations such as Cornerstone or others for their expertise, because we certainly don't have it within our office. So it's part of a larger conversation and not a direct endorsement to move forward with anything at this point.
And then but is there anyone besides Cornerstone that you guys recognize with the expertise to do this?
That is not a conversation we have had.
Boy, you guys got a talking to, didn't you?
Mr. Bilbeck. Mitzi, curious about your trying to make contact with the city of Minneapolis. What are you hoping to gain from talking to them?
Well,
where are they? I mean, have they been going down this road for a longer period of time?
I don't know when it started, and I'll ask Jeff if he has any of those details, because he's actually been making the attempt to contact specific folks. We're really hoping to learn what they're moving forward with, what they're considering, what the status of it is, and learn why it's not moving forward, too. I mean, okay. There are a range of questions. Jeff, I don't know.
That's basically the answer. We heard that Minneapolis was involved, but they are involved right at the present time of initiating the idea of inclusionary housing policy or regulation in their community. Their process requires initiation by a council member to get it on the docket. It's been on the docket. It's been referred to their planning and zoning commission and their planning and zoning committee of council members. And now it's back at the staff level. So I was trying to get hold of the staff person because that's who the only person would talk to me about it.
It just seems like it's hidden the snag there.
I don't know what the specifics of it are, but they're the biggest city in Minnesota. They'd give us the best.
Mr. Nomai. Yeah,
the staff's job in this case wasn't to make a recommendation one way or another on inclusionary zoning. Ours was a request to find out what other communities are doing, and is it that simple that you just leap to adopting a policy? And so that's what the effort was, to give you more information. I would say, there was, in one of the studies, it mentions a number of cities that are looking at it. It's Chaska, Edina, Maple Grove, communities such as that. They're different than, there's not really a direct comparable to Rochester, in my opinion, in any of the cities in the list. The suburban communities, they don't have room for workers in their communities because their lot sizes are larger. Those are pretty affluent communities when you look at that group. So, and I wouldn't say Minneapolis is directly comparable either, or St. Cloud. So, it is a topic that we don't have a recommendation on, but we see it as an issue that was just one to give you information on, and then you have more information to decide where you want to go on this, because it did seem to us that there wasn't a lot of background information at the last meeting.
Mr. Campbell.
So I, for one, want to say thanks. You prepared a lot of the information I was hoping to get. And, I read through all the information that was provided. And then I realized that I kind of want to take a step back, because I think the question, and when you look at those guiding lines about what an incentive development is, it's a negotiation. These should come to council. It literally has the word negotiation in it. This is supposed to be a give and take. And when I look at what happens oftentimes, it doesn't feel necessarily like developers are coming in with an understanding of what the council wants. So I look at this and go, 90% of the battle is laying out those things that we want. And we can say that this has no tangible effect on the outcome, but if we have an element in there that says rooftop terraces, I don't think we should be surprised when someone brings forward an incentive and claims a rooftop terrace, right? And yet I would argue that rooftop terraces to our community have relatively limited utility. It's limited to the people inside the building. And maybe you can make an argument about these larger view sheds, but I think that it's debatable, the value. And maybe we're going to find that several council members think inclusionary zone or affordable housing is debatable. But if we don't communicate up front that our community values affordable housing, which I think we do, but we maybe mix it in with a bunch of things that are of more debatable and probably easier to attain, I don't think we should be surprised when path of least resistance, somebody needs to get a bigger development, they're hanging on, balconies, or they're putting on rooftop terraces instead of looking at the position that they need to provide this housing. I had this position before Cornerstone came forward, that we have some challenges in this area that need to be addressed. In particular, I just think that these ones that are a marginal value to the public, if we're in agreement that they are, we need to set the conversation up front that says, in this negotiation, we want you to win, because your win is our win. That's how this process should work out. But if we're setting you up with bring in rooftop terraces, and ask for 2x the density, we're not setting you up to win, because that's not a way, that's not going to be a winner for a large portion of the council. So I guess from my perspective, you know, I just ask us to go over, you know, and they did a great job of putting all the incentives in here. Going over these probably, and maybe this is a personal exercise for each council member, but there's a lot in here that I think, and they just happened to touch on a few of them in their thing, but, you know, are these what we want to be communicating, are the negotiating points for developers that are looking to do a win-win with the city? And just saying that, well, you know, we're left a lot of latitude to deny even though they bring it forward, that, you know, we don't have those sorts of discussions at council. What shows up is, here's our proposal, take it or leave it. So unless we are equipping people ahead of time to negotiate equitably with staff, we're setting people up for failure. And I don't want failure. I want success. You're right. The goal is to produce a project that is better through this process than they could get normally for the community and for the developer. But unless we set them up correctly, I feel like this is leading to a lot of, you know, misinterpretation of the rules. There is no point system. You can't tell walking in whether or not you're on the right side of the negotiation. Why wouldn't we provide more feedback and more information to this to say, these are our goals for the city. Let's incorporate them into these. These are what you can achieve if you meet what we are desiring for our community. And so maybe that's a complicated conversation to have. I accept that. I can tell based on the thickness of some of the packet material I got. It's a complicated conversation, but it's one that I think as a council we again need to revisit and make sure that we do that pruning of that list to make sure it is, you know, reiterating what we think is important.
Maybe picking up a little bit on what Mr. Campion is talking about, I highlighted a comment out of the staff comments that there's no one-size-fits-all policy in communities or using a variety of things. And you highlight four things: incentive programs, which you've already talked about, land development zoning standard, discretionary land use, and then finally inclusionary zoning. And that's defined as things that we would mandate in certain developments to receive benefit or be designated as an inclusionary zoning. So, and maybe that gets a little bit to what Mr. Campion is talking about. What are the things that we are willing to state up front that these are the things that we would very much like to see as part of an inclusionary zoning, at least as that part of the overall strategy that we look at when we look at any given project. So, Mr. Campion.
You almost had my touchdown, but the only thing I would point out is on page 11 in the packet, the last three paragraphs of the submission there seem to pretty clearly call out that the only policy that seems to be affecting a real change to the availability of affordable housing is a mandatory policy. You know, the researchers have reached the conclusion. This seems to be the best available tool for achieving mixed income developments. I think there's also this acceptance of those involved that this is a complex tool, but it may be the best available tool based on the available research of the others that are taking place. And I'll leave it at that.
Yeah. And I think the tricky part is what elements are you willing to itemize and enumerate so that would comprise an inclusionary housing policy, Mr. Wargan?
So one of the questions, you mentioned the fee in lieu of, which actually has been a phenomenal solution for other communities, but based on the research that I've been doing, I don't think you can do the fee in lieu of in Minnesota. Do you know on that? I think it's prohibited in our state.
Got it.
Mr. Dunn?
Let me add something in because I was looking at that very issue.
Yeah, okay.
With the same concern, and that comes from, I believe it's an Edina policy,
yeah,
where they're not using that as an inclusionary zoning per se. It's a criteria that the council uses in rezoning decision making. And so what they're saying with their policy, and again, many of, like most of these are very new policies, and so a lot of them haven't really fully been vetted yet. So the idea behind the policy is that if you want a rezoning for a multifamily project, we either want X number of affordable units or a fee in lieu of XYZ, and that gets you to the discretionary decision making.
Okay.
The question would be whether that is whether it's legal. And I don't have any answer to that, but that's just what the policy is.
Well, and I, actually, that helps a little bit, but in particular what I'm thinking of is that some, depending on developments and locations, it might make more sense to have them cash out and help with affordable units somewhere else. And it seems to me that that's what's explicitly prohibited in the state of Minnesota. And
I would think that's, if the council is interested in cash and loan, we'd want to research that a little further.
Well, and that's part of why, you know, someone like the Cornerstone Partnership can be very helpful, because they do this. And just echo on what Nick said here is that if you really want to do something to affect affordable housing in your community, inclusionary zoning nationwide has been shown as hands down the only truly universally effective policy that has worked.
Mr. Hickey. So I also think in the staff report you mentioned the 7 communities in Minnesota that have tried it, that it's failed for some reason and it's been rescinded. So I want more information on what their experience was. Maybe something unique to Minnesota that makes this more challenging. I don't know. But I definitely want more information on that.
I think that was just in the St. Cloud area. I think there's others that are doing it. That's where we could get more information on what happened in St. Cloud.
I would actually, if I'd appreciate that information too. That's a good question.
And if, you know, I know that we're running up against some time limit here, but I do want to kind of separate the issue too, because I think the going and looking at affordable housing policy and inclusionary zoning is good. I had reservations about the incentive development, which is no surprise to the planning and zoning staff, because they had to put up with me for 8-7 years before I came to the council. I still think, you know, I'd like to re-up this on the council agenda in the future and maybe have an opportunity for council members to take a look at, because I know this is a long list, and get some feedback about what we do, what we incent already, because I really do want to promote the types of things that we want, because the incentive development process is the best process we have. It allows us a ton of flexibility. It yields better results. I am a firm believer we can make this process better. So if that would be something people would be amenable to, I'd really like to maybe sit down and go through this and write up some kind of commentary for consideration.
So no, that I would be willing to agree with. I think Nick did just exactly what it needs to be. I totally agree with him. I would support that.
I, you know, my thing on the inclusionary zoning is it's a topic that's relatively new to Minnesota, and I would agree with finding out information on the ones that didn't work, but at some point, we have to fish or cut bait on this issue. We will have to make a decision that one way or the other will be widely popular. I would prefer us to be proactive and make that decision in an expedient time frame, rather than just keep pushing this thing down the road. You know, I've brought up a number of times that this housing report was going to be November of 2014 with the plans and recommendations, and we just are not doing enough to address the affordable housing issues in this community.
I think we're going to put a timeline on, like everything. We need to put deadlines and timelines on. Go from there.
So is that feedback you guys think you can provide with the other cities in a week? Does that seem reasonable?
Yeah, I think the other thing that might be valuable for the council to look at is how many affordable housing units have you supported through some level of TIF or financial assistance over maybe the last few years, because you can look at that and measure locally if we had had inclusionary zoning as a policy, which of those options yield more units. And I don't know the answer, but it might be of value to look at that. Maybe they're not all that different. Maybe there is a big difference.
I would say on our end, we haven't been waiting. You've approved hundreds of units, and we're working on more at the present time. So we're not waiting. I suppose the only issue we're waiting on is the inclusionary zoning issue. We're not waiting on using TIF or housing bonds.
You can continue your discussion on this matter next Monday, which I meet with the county board on housing issues.
Perfect. That's a good idea.
Does that mean you're hungry?
All right. Good. Yes. We'll continue the discussion. Oh, thank you. We are there.